Hi, I'm Claire Mitchell QC. Welcome to the Witches of Scotland podcast. I'm a lawyer who specialises in miscarriage of justice cases, and we're bringing you this podcast because we want to tell you about the women who were accused, prosecuted, convicted, and ultimately executed as witches in Scotland.
I'm Zoe Venditozzi, and I'm a writer who's always had an interest in the witches, and I feel that this dark mark against Scotland needs a reckoning.
The campaign Witches of Scotland wants three things. Firstly, a pardon for all those convicted of witchcraft. Secondly, an apology for all those who were accused as witches. And finally, a national monument in recognition of all those who are affected by this terrible miscarriage of justice.
Over the forthcoming weeks, we'll be talking to a whole host of experts about the history and the modern day connections to the Witches of Scotland. Hello and welcome to the Witches of Scotland podcast. This week we're on episode 25 and we're going to be having an international slant to this week's episode. We've got an exciting event happening this weekend to tie in with International Women's Day, which is that we've got an event on Sunday, so that's the 7th of March, from 3 till 4. It's going to feature me, Claire, and Sarah Sheridan, author of Where Are the Women? So that was one of the things that, in fact, inspired Claire to start off the campaign. And we're very happy because Sarah's actually given us two signed hardbacks to give away. So if you have a look on our socials, you'll see the links to go and sign up for that event. So that's free and there's loads of people signed up already, so that's sure to be good.
Yes, Zoe, that's not the only thing we're appearing in. We're also appearing in an event which is being held in Paisley Online, and that's on International Women's Day. It's a fantastic lineup of people all talking about the history of women in Scotland and being convicted of witches. And they've got a fantastic lineup, including former podcast guests, one of which is the fabulous award-winning Julia Campanelli. As our listeners will know, she has written a screenplay called The Paisley Witch Trial, and actually she's going to be performing some part of her award-winning script at the end of the talk that we have, so I'm really looking forward to that. And the other person is the wonderful counsellor Kate Stewart, who we've also had on. She was a founding member of ROS, and she was also instrumental in getting the Fife Witches Trail put up, and that, of course, as our listeners will know, was in remembrance of Lilias Ady and the other women that were killed as witches in Cuirass.
Now, just for the benefit of those people that are not fully up to speed with all the different groups that are campaigning away in the background, ROS, which you've just mentioned there, stands for Remembering the Accused Witches of Scotland, who you can find on Facebook and who have been instrumental, as you said, with the Witches Trail in Fife. So we'll just mention that there so we make sure that everybody gets their just respect in the podverse. Okay, so we are really, really excited by the fact that the campaign is really reaching out to the world now, and some exciting things have happened in the last week only. And one of those is that there was a really fantastic article in the Wall Street Journal that really gave a fantastic overview of the issue of witches right across the world, so different international concerns. And one of the things they talked about was, in fact, the Witches of Scotland campaigns. That was really nice to see, wasn't it, Claire?
Yeah. I mean, as we know, we were interviewed for that a while back, and we were really keen to see whether or not we'd make it to print. If anyone can't get past it, there's a wall on it, and maybe we'll do a summary of it at some point in the future, because some people can only get to a certain point and it won't allow them past it. But it really does show why this campaign is so necessary, front and central, because it highlights the fact that around the world there are still so many people being called witches again, women, children, men, but mostly women, and how it's been used as a tool of persecution. So it also interestingly draws the comment that whilst people who were involved in the Salem witch trials got justice hundreds of years beforehand, the people of Scotland are still waiting to get justice for those people who were killed as witches. So we're delighted. And as a result of that, we've just had so much contact from other places around the world as well. And can see when we look at the petition, there are people signing from all over the world. I saw in the last few that had signed Norway, Chile, Argentina, countries that we wouldn't think that we would be able to reach. And presumably that's because of doing interviews for the Wall Street Journal. They have a much broader reach than our podcast ever could. But there's a further and a very, very exciting turn of events for us, Zoe. Can you tell us about the next thing that reaches further than we ever thought our campaign and podcast would?
No, it's fantastic. There's a magazine in Catalonia, which is called Sapiens, which is the leading historical and cultural magazine. And they have launched their own campaign to have the witches of their area pardoned, I think, and apologized to as well. And they have said that part of their initial idea about it was they were inspired by our campaign, which is really gratifying that we played a part in that. And they have had, the way they launched their petition was they've got 150 history professors to sign in support of it. And in only 3 days, they're already on 6,500 signatures, which is really remarkable. So please, you know, don't let Catalan put us in the shade. Our petition is still up at the Scottish Parliament website. And at the moment, we're on about 1,600 signatures, which is still amazing. We've got a couple of weeks left, and it'd be really, really great to have people sign that if they can. Just again, the more signatures we have, the more it looks, you know, like it's a clear case that the government should just get involved with. But their magazine this month, so it's Sapiens, is dedicated to women who were killed as witches. We gave an interview to them, so that appears in there as well. And also by the magic of the internet, we appear at their event on this International Women's Day as well. So actually it's a third thing we're doing, Claire, over International Women's Day. So we'll put links to all those things. And because we're talking about Catalan and their own campaign, we thought it'd be a good idea this week to have a little look at some of the Catalan people that were accused as witches in our section where we look at different witches. So they're humanized basically, and that we know about who they are. So I'm going to tell you a very little bit about the Terrassa witch trials. And before I start, here is an interesting thing as somebody that really likes language. The Catalan word for witch is pronounced bruixa, according to Google Translate. That's how it pronounced it. I'm probably saying it with a slightly Fife accent, so I'm sure Catalan listeners would be like, not quite hen, in Catalan. But it's bruixa. And it's interesting to think about the parallels that we have in other countries. So there's one of their trials, which is really well known, is the Terrassa witch trials. And they took place in Terrassa in Catalonia between 1615 and 1619, so equivalent to around about our times. Six women of the city of Terrassa were accused of witchcraft and sentenced to death on the 27th of October, 1619. There were two trials. On the first trial, which was in 2nd of July, 1615, the Holy Office of Barcelona asked the local authorities to transfer the accused women to the Catalan capital. And out of the 11 women that were accused, only three were incarcerated. Now, again, please don't be cross if I've said pronounced these names incorrectly. I'll do my best. So there's Margarita Cotilla, Michaela Casanovas, who's also known as Escolopera, and Guillermina Font, who's also known as Miramunda. The others were released to return to Terrassa or flee to other cities. Those that returned to Terrassa continued to be suspected of witchcraft and were persecuted, publicly stoned, or accused of prostitution, which I think is quite interesting because we've talked a wee bit about witches that were accused but then didn't get executed, but about how they might have been banished in Scotland or at the very least their lives ruined with this taint of witchcraft. So I think that's quite interesting. Then there was a second trial, and there was a real climate of hysteria apparently in the town. So when the trial happened on the 26th of December, 1618, the officials of the town of Terrassa invited the witch hunter. Now it's J-O-A-N. I'm not sure how you pronounce that. I don't know if it's Juan or not. I'm going to say Juan. Okay. Juan Font from Selent, agreeing to pay his expenses from the public purse. So they brought in a witch finder, a witch hunter. And with his help, they formed a civil tribunal on the 23rd of May, 1619, that consisted of the mayor and his advisors. So again, lots of men accusing women. They detained and condemned six women, some of which had already been released by the Inquisition a few years before. And their names were, so some of these are repeats from the ones that I mentioned earlier, Margarita Cotilla, Juana de Toy, Juana Sabina, Michaela Casanovas, Eulalia Toxta, and Guillermina Font, who was also known as Miramunda. The women were accused of various things. In one of them, they're quite strange, as they often are, these accusations. In one of them, Margarita Tafanera was accused by her own brother of bewitching his wife so that they couldn't have children, so that she, Margarita, would inherit all his assets. Okay, so again, we're talking about money and land here. In another accusation, a neighbor called Anthony Ubres stated that the women met on Thursday nights in an area called La Cuadra de Empaye, where they waited for the devil, who appeared on a chair wearing red. When he appeared, the neighbour said that the women kissed his hand. After the devil served what's described as a sinister dinner, I'm quite curious about that, he played the flute and fell into a scandalous orgy with the women. So again, it's sex and partying and suspicions that women are, I think, are having a good time, or by accusing them of sexual relations with the devil, it then makes them so disgusting and abhorrent that they can be dealt with any way they see fit. The women were also accused of sacrificing animals, bewitching people, murder, and many other misdeeds. So the witch hunter testified to the mayor and his advisors that after washing the backs of Joanna Toy and Margarita Tafanera with holy water, he found the sign that the devil used to mark his witches. So equivalent to what we've talked about here as well. Margarita Tafanera confessed to being a witch, probably under torture, just like we had here. And she named a French woman called Joanna Ferez as their witchcraft teacher and said that they met frequently in the house of Joanna Toy. She also explained that they scrubbed their armpits and other parts of the body and flew through the air to meet under a pine tree with a demon who appeared as a very handsome young man wearing red clothes. So we had the devil in red earlier as well. The demon played the flabiol, and usually the meeting ended in an orgy. I'm presuming that the flabiol is an instrument of some sort, a musical instrument. But I think it's interesting that it's following the same pattern. It's music and then debauched behaviour, supposedly. Under interrogation, Joanna Toy confessed that she was French and she was the sister of Juan de la Boqueria. However, initially she denied that she was a witch or that she knew the rest of the accused women. However, unsurprisingly, after torture, she confirmed the accusations against Margarita Tafanera and added that a French woman called Perona, who lived in Martorell, taught her the skills of witchcraft. It's quite interesting that, because there's been two mentions there of witchcraft teachers. So
yeah, it's sure. Been passed down from one to the other, or passing down skills.
When Margarita Tafanera was questioned, she was tortured as well. But despite that, she said that she didn't know anything about what she was being accused of. And during the second extortion of the judge, she said, "Kill me so that you will have to give an account to God," which is quite interesting. So despite the fact that she was tortured, she held strong, held to the truth, and said to them, "You will be judged." You know, I mean, obviously it's a Catholic country, saying, "Kill me, and then you'll have to deal with God because you've done the wrong thing and I'm innocent," which is quite interesting. So the accused were incarcerated in the castle of Terrassa and tortured. As it was impossible for the Inquisition to convene a retrial, the women were kept in the Torre del Palacio, or Palace Tower, until a civil trial was convened. So I don't know if this is a bit different, Claire. Once convicted, their sentence was read out publicly, and five of the women were hanged in the area Pedra Blanca, near to a present-day Weybridge, on the 27th of October, 1619. So the women that were hanged were called Margarita Tafanera, Eulalia Toxta, Juana Sabina, Guillermina Font, also known as Miramunda, and Michaela Casanovas, known as Esclopera. So these are the women, most of them were the ones from the first trial. However, to this day, it's not known what happened to Joanna Toy. And again, I'm really, really sorry for mangling some of those names. I know that the X in Catalan language isn't pronounced in the way that I've pronounced it, but I'm not really sure how to say it properly. So I'm really sorry.
I think you definitely got the more difficult one to do this week, Zoe. That's for sure.
But it's interesting to see the parallels between Catalan, which on the face of it is a very different type of country to the Scotland of the time, I would imagine, you know, very different, different religion. Obviously, they were Catholic and ours were very much not Catholic. So it's interesting, I think, to see the parallels. And again, I think the thing that they have in common is that they were women, you know, and that they were accused of doing terrible things, then diminished and dispatched as the men of the time saw fit. And I know that there were men obviously killed as witches and there were men that were executed. But this is interesting, this story, because it is women.
They were the men that were mostly killed were ancillary in the story, usually to the women. I remember Professor Goodyear said to us something like, you know, the men might be attending one of these coven meetings, but they would be there playing music or something. They would be associated with witchcraft. It was strange that the allegations of witchcraft, the actual witchcraft, came to women. And yes, 15% of people convicted of witchcraft and accused of witchcraft were men. The themes are universal. The themes are just human. It's just women in a certain place at a certain time where They are being accused of things that are farcical and being tortured and being asked to confess things. And when they do confess things, the same type of things are coming up all over again. They're being asked, what did the devil wear? What did you do? Did you have sex with the devil? I mean, it's not difficult to come up with the same kind of confessions when you're asking the same sorts of questions. And that's what religion appeared obsessed by, whether or not women were having sex with the devil.
Has it in fact changed? I don't think so. No. Okay, so moving away from Catalan, we're going to come back to Scotland now, as we usually do. And Claire, you're going to tell us about something here.
We are. The person that's come to speak to us today, and we're going to hear from shortly, is going to be speaking about an amazing piece of work by Jeanette Archibald called The Devil's Mark. It's a play, and this was written by Jeanette, and it was shown in 2002. The play has now been put into a beautiful book with images by Karen Strang, who, of course, regular listeners will know we have spoken to already, who has provided really sometimes quite difficult images to look at in relation to what happened to women during the course of this trial, but absolutely compelling. And I was delighted to receive a copy of it and had a read through it. And I found the play absolutely fascinating. And we'll hear a bit more about it in due course. But the play's central character was a real woman who lived in Clackmannan and was accused of being a witch. As in Catalan, so in Scotland, a mark was looked for on women to see whether they were in league with the devil. They were stripped and then they were investigated for having a devil's mark. And this play is called The Devil's Mark. Information on her is held at the Stirling Presbytery Records and the Scottish Survey of Witchcraft, which we have looked up to collate this information. I've also got information on the background from the book which has been written about the play, which gives you fabulous background information as well. Well, what do we know about our woman who was killed as a witch today? What do we know about Margaret Duckall? Margaret Duckall was 45 years old when she was accused in 1658. She was first accused in the May of that year, and it appears she went to trial in June. She came from Clackmannan, as I've said, and went to trial in Alloa, along with 16 other women. Three investigators and an elder investigated the case, obviously all men. She was tortured and confessed that often she met the devil, along with others, at 12 o'clock at night. She told them that the devil wore black and brown, obviously different from Catalan, where he wore red, and his name was John. She confessed that she complained to the devil about people who had insulted her or owed money, and the devil would punish them and kill them. And she was found to have the devil's mark on her eyebrow. Now, very sadly, she died after trial, but before sentence could be pronounced. I suppose that is very sad in some ways, Zoe, but in fact, what it is a mercy that she died in that way, rather being put through being strangled and burned.
It's reminiscent of the Lilias AD case as well, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. Women taken in, tortured for a month, as it appeared to be in this case, and obviously as a result of that, just dying.
I wonder how many women and men that there were across Scotland that were accused and tortured and died before they could be executed, because I bet they're not all kept as records.
No. That's why, I mean, as we know, the records are very poor, particularly the first sort of wave of satanic panic. But yes, there will be lots like that. Even in a case like Lilias Eadie's, where Doug Spears told us so many good records were kept, when she died, the reason that we know she died is they just stopped speaking about her.
Mm.
Wasn't a note of her taken. So she wasn't alone in the allegations against her. She was put to trial along with several other women. And the names of those 16 other women were Catherine Rainey, Bessie Payton, Jonet Black, Margaret Taylor, Catherine Keg, Barbara Erskine, Bessie Harl, Catherine Whiteman, Elizabeth Croak, Janet Meeson, Janet Reed, and Janet Miller. There was also Margaret Dempston, Elspeth Black, and a man called James Kirk. So what we do know is that four of these people were executed. We know that Catherine Rainey, Bessie Payton, Jonet Black and Margaret Taylor were executed, but we simply don't know what happened to the others. So today we remember the women of Catalonia and the women of Clackmannan and Alloa, Margaret Ducal and the 16 others that were accused as witches, some of them we know were executed, and now we will be able to turn to consider the Devil's Mark, and we look forward to speaking to Hazel about that.
We're delighted today to be joined by Hazel Meldrum, who's a publisher and teacher, who has been working on her mother Janet Archibald's play The Devil's Mark to bring it out in a new publication, working with the artist Karen Strang, who we've spoken to in one of our previous episodes. So today we're going to hear all about the book, the process of it, the research, how it was made, what the reception is for it. And I think it's going to be really fascinating. So without any further ado, we'd like to welcome Hazel to The Witches of Scotland.
And thank you for inviting me. I'm really pleased to be here.
First of all, Hazel, I wonder if you could tell us a wee bit about the woman who causes us to be all here, which is your mum, Janet Archibald. Can you tell us about her?
Yeah, she was a historian. She was really interested in history, always growing up. She was always taking us to museums and different places. But I think most of it was really focused in local history where she grew up. So Alloa and Clackmannanshire was something of a kind of project for her. In her later years, she actually was a curator of Alloa Museum when it existed. There's not actually a museum anymore. It's just a collection. And I think there's various sort of exhibitions put on when things are open. But she just loved going to, at that time, would be the library because there was no internet. And just working for hours and hours looking through microfiche, you know, really researching the local area. And so she wrote a lot of articles for the local paper. She's had a few things published in Scottish Memories and really dug up some information on different people from the past. And one example was William Burns Patterson, who opened a school called Tullibuddy Academy in Alabama for black children. And she kind of uncovered all that. And I think there's now links between Alloa and Alabama because of that. But she was really interested in the witch trials, and she came across that and started to research that in the 1990s. And she wrote a small playette based on her research. And I think one of the local secondary schools performed that at the time. She used to go around local community and do talks about local history. In particular, she talked about some women. And usually at the end of her talks, she would always mention some words by Maya Angelou. And she would say, "You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the dirt, but still, like dust, I rise."
It's a great poem, that one.
It was a few years later, I think in 2002, that she expanded on the research, and she wrote a longer play and had that performed in Alloa Tower. And she involved some of the local school children in the performance and mostly local people as well. But she became quite ill after that. The play was always kind of just lying around as a script on white A4 paper. At the time, Karen Strang was really involved in that as well, with an exhibition during the performance. And it was a few years ago that Karen came to her attention again. Sister and I met Karen, and she was doing more research on the witch trials in Glendevin and Cooris, and she was putting together a big exhibition, which was called The Burning of the Tide, and I think you mentioned that earlier. It was then that we thought about my mum's script again, and we spoke to Karen and had a discussion on putting, you know, a nice publication together. And would she mind incorporating some of her paintings in there? Because there were these links between my mum and Karen years ago. So we had some snow days. I think the schools were closed for about 3 days. And that's when we did it. I typed it up and Heather designed it. We proofread it, and Karen gave us her paintings to incorporate in there. And we did it in just a few days, a few years ago.
What was it that made you think, right, we're going to revisit this and bring this to a wider audience?
I think just recently, after myself having decided to retire eventually from teaching, and I was always interested in working with Heather in a graphic design business. And years ago, I had thought about doing a publishing course. And I just sort of decided, this is right, I'm going to apply and try and, you know, eventually gradually get out of teaching and do this, something different. After doing the course, I've just finished last year, just as we came into lockdown, I think, finished my dissertation. You know, just studying that topic, we looked at, nowadays, people want a little bit more than a book. They want something a wee bit more special. And I just decided to think about the Devil's Mark and make it a little bit special in that I wanted to hand wrap it. So we hand wrapped it with a wax seal, and we've got a publisher stamp, tied it with string, just something simple, something that would reflect the times mm-hmm. of the 17th century. And we put the original programme in as well. And it just as an extra little thing, we put one of the miniature, what we'd call a witch bottle, I think Karen, that's what her exhibition was at the time. She had little artistic pieces inside miniature bottles to kind of reflect the beliefs, the traditions, the spells, or whatever it is we would call them. I think sometimes just healing, things to heal. And that's in with the small programme. And so that just makes it a bit more special as well.
I can definitely tell you it was really, really special to receive the book. And it is the work itself, which we'll come to, no doubt, that you can tell us about. It is beautifully illustrated by Karen's work. But the setting out of the book as well, telling about the history of the Celtic gods, how they interacted, the history of Joan of Arc, why she is relevant to this particular conversation. I think it's fantastic, and it is different from what I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be a sort of narrative, straightforward narrative tale of a trial that took place, and it's anything but that. It's like the book is anything but a book. The actual story of The Devil's Mark as a play is anything but. I wonder if you could tell us, and I don't want you to give away spoilers to those that might be reading them, but I wonder if you could tell us in general what The Devil's Mark is about.
Well, I think in knowing my mum, I think she was really interested in highlighting how women were oppressed, but not just in 1658. She wanted to show that it transcends different ages. And she was also very interested in Celtic beliefs and in belief systems being passed down through times, through generations. And I think to try and bring these women together from different ages, she set it at a time that the Celtics believed where time was, the veils of time were thin. And the festival of Madryn, when, you know, the autumn equinox, when day and night are the same sort of lengths. And so she used that as a setting to try and bring women from different ages together. So you have Niamh of the golden hair, who in Celtic mythology was the daughter, supposed daughter of the god of Manu, the sea god.
Can I just say there, I saw in the book that Manu the sea god, his spirit is said to be trapped inside a stone, which people can actually still go and see.
Yes, that's right. And that is in Clackmannan, where I think the name must have come from, the sea god Manu, and it's only a few miles along the road from Alloa.
So that's definitely something we want to go and visit. But sorry, so you said there was Niamh with the golden hair.
Yep, so she comes into the play. And then there's Joan of Arc, who of course was in the early 15th century, a different age altogether. And there's quite a history around this area as well. There's I think there's a statue to Joan of Arc in Stirling, which is just not far away from here either. And in Scotland, she was called Jeannie Dark.
This is news to me. I love that. Claire told me that today, and I cannot believe that. It's such a cool thing.
Yeah. And
she's going to be Jeannie Dark from here on in for me. I'll not have it said any other way.
Jeannie Dark. I wish I'd known that when a few years ago, we were on holiday and we were driving through France, and we went to the cathedral where her remains are. Yeah. Well, I don't know if her remains are there, but there's, it's like her cathedral. And I wish I'd known that. I would have been saying to people, it's just me, Jeannie Dark.
And it's quite interesting. And I think Karen Strang has also another painting where she was thinking about Jeannie Dark and also Hegarty and the Goddess of the Moon. So that's another one that is one of my favourites. But yet, Jeannie Dark comes into the play as well as a character. So she is there to try and save the spirit of Margaret Dougal, who is the main character in the play and was actually one of the accused in the Alba Witch Trials.
Can you tell us a wee bit about Margaret herself being accused?
I think the impression I get of Margaret is that she's just an ordinary, lonely woman who is actually homeless. She doesn't have, and this is not even just from the play, but I have read the actual the scripts from the trials. So she had nowhere to go, nowhere to stay, so she stays with a friend. But you can see in the play, I think what my mum's been trying to show is how she's been tortured and imprisoned for so long that she's possibly gone a bit mad. There's a slight madness there, and through, you can imagine through sleep deprivation and torture that this is what would happen. In fact, she does actually confess, and she doesn't actually she isn't burnt at the stake or drowned or anything, because she dies from being tortured, and this is quite sad in a terrible way. The whole play, and the saddest part of the play for me was in scene 4. It was nothing to do with their lives as it really was, but it was a day where it was the May Festival. And the May Festival, they were terrified that they were going to be found out about this May Day, because Cromwell had banned Elton, had banned the May Festival. But it was just that they had such an enjoyable day in the woods near the Fairy Burn with the bluebells, and, you know, a new day, it was opening up. And I think it was Nellie didn't want to remember that day. And she didn't want to remember it because it was such a good day. And I think Agnes had said, well, you know, maybe some people have days like this every day. And I just felt it was one of the saddest parts of the book, even though, you know, other parts were dealing with the madness and the torture.
It's just a very simple reflection on how sad some of these people's lives were and how much they had to live the lives that they wanted to live, compromised and in terror of being discovered, in terror of some people were, for example, in the earlier times, not Christians at all, and they believed all sorts of different things. You spoke about Neve with the golden hair, and those sorts of religions, old religions, went arm in arm with the modern religions until it became dangerous, because it became to follow those or to keep up those old stories made you more likely to be involved in something that wasn't godly, because it wasn't the Christian God. And I found that was very powerful in the play.
Some of the other characters as well, the idea of difference came in there as well, because there was the other character who had a skeely e. It made me think about my mum, actually, because she did have a slight squint in her eye when she was a child.
We've got international listeners.
Oh, yes.
Who won't know what it is you mean by that. So you might have to just explain the Scots term that you've just used there.
So a skeely e was just a squint in your eye, which made you different from most people, I suppose. And I think it might have been my mum drawing on her own experience of that, because she did have a slight squint when she was a child, which was corrected through wearing glasses. But I never thought about it at the time. She never, ever mentioned it. But I think she probably did experience that when she was younger, that she was picked out as being different, and that was something that she used to draw on her experience. The same as I think she drew on some of her experience with her grandparents, or grandmother, in fact, who was, well, she was born in the middle of the 1800s, but she was one who people would go to for healing, something to heal them, poultices, salts, socks to put on sores, because going to a doctor was really expensive at the time. So she grew up with these women who I think were strong women as well, I remember her telling me a story about her great-grandmother who had seemingly had been married but had a child a month later and was told at the time to go to the kirk to have her sins read out. And she had told the minister to go and read out his own sins, she wasn't, and she threw him out of the house. So she had all of these kind of strong women that would stand up for themselves, you know, and maybe a century earlier, they might have been accused of being witches and they had gone through the same as Margaret Dickel. So yeah, that was quite, some of the characters are quite interesting.
My favourite part of the play is actually scene 6, when different women from different times come together and they all speak. You have Niamh, obviously from much earlier times, the Celtic religion. You've got women from 17th century, modern women, 18th century, and the suffragette. And I thought that that was amazing that she had all those different women. I actually found it really emotional that she had all these different women talking about their experience of not being treated equally or not having a fair chance to explore what they wanted in their life because of the way that they were judged and they were treated in society. I thought that was very, very poignant.
Yeah, that was a nice scene as well. And I think there she's highlighting the oppression of women, as I said, over these different centuries, but also maybe highlight how strong women can be if they're together and stand up. And I liked how she had used the imagery of standing stones in that scene as well, that they were like standing stones. It was also interesting that the suffragette character had pointed out that it was mostly single women who had time, had no children, and were not with men who were controlling their lives, that they were the women who were helping them with their projects, with their protests. And again, it was a lot of the women who were accused of being witches were single women as well, albeit some of them were middle-aged, older women who were suspicious of because there was no man in their life. It was an interesting scene, that one as well.
That came through really, really strongly about women helping women. And I think that's part of what that scene was talking about, sort of women passing their stories on through the centuries. And one thing I was very struck by that I mentioned to Zoe was the fact that the suffragette brought the thing right up to the 20th century.
Yeah.
It said women weren't allowed to vote because they weren't seen as equal to men. And it's the exact same misogynistic view that was present in the 17th century, in the 18th century, in the 19th century, and the 20th century. And so when people say to us, what's the point in this? What's the point in asking for a pardon or an apology or a national monument for these people? They seem to think that the struggles that women have, not only in Scotland but worldwide, are clearly, they think that these are things of the past and they're very much things of the present.
Yep, I think my mum would have loved the idea of getting a pardon for the women who were, you know, accused of being witches, who were murdered actually because of that. I think if she was here, she would be right in there with you. In teaching, I think I'm quite interested in fear and control and how people in power control people through fear. And I think, I don't know, teaching the Crucible to some pupils at school, it's been quite interesting looking at what is it, although, you know, we look at Arthur Miller's The Crucible and the Witch Hunts, and of course it was mostly about communism at the time and how that was more like a witch hunt as well. And we kind of experimented and looked at other areas, what in society, other things have we been scared of, and is that, you know, a source of control as well? I think at the time when we discussed it, the things we were most scared of were terrorism, and at that time, is it manipulated? Are we manipulated at times as well? Through fear. I suppose the virus as well is another fear at the moment.
One of the things that Claire and I've talked about, and Claire's just mentioned there, is current day misogyny. You know, and it's interesting that the Crucible is what most of us in Scotland that know, you know, that we think about, if we did do the Crucible at school, most people that stayed on, I think beyond 40 are probably have done it, it seems like.
Yeah.
But the, you know, the people think of the Crucible first before their own country's stories of witchcraft, you know. I think that's quite interesting. And I think what you're talking about there, about the McCarthyism, communism, fear and control thing, we've talked about this before, but like current controls that we have, they're all played out through social media. You know, that people, you know, don't want to say particular things, or there's other groups that have particular control, or there's misinformation that, you know, you're talking about manipulation. So I think, as I would just reiterate what Claire was saying, and I think what you're saying with the play, which is that these things are not solved or done away with. They're very much as present now as they were. Obviously, women in Britain aren't executed for witchcraft, but there is still this, you know, control of women. And one of the things that Claire and I feel really strongly about is that Scotland needs to signal this internationally, that we recognise it, because there are still some places where witchcraft is used, or accusations of witchcraft is used as a means of control of women and some men. And we just really think that that's, it's amazing that it's still kind of going on. So I think anything that we can do to, in a small part, bring that to the international stage, as it were, I think is really useful. Have you taken the Devil's Mark out with Scotland?
Yeah, with the development and the launch of shop, our online shop, we're kind of promoting it all over the world now. So we've had some orders. I mean, it's only been a month, but we've had some orders in America, Canada, and the Netherlands so far. So yeah, it's available, and just, you know, doing different things to try and promote it. I think International Women's Day is probably another good one benefit from that.
Absolutely. Can you tell people where they can get it, what the name of your shop is? We'll obviously supply links when we are doing our socials and promoting the podcast. We'll provide links for it. But if you can just tell people listening what to look out for.
Yep, it's available with some of the other local writers that we're promoting, is at Heather and Dowd Limited. So the website is www.heatherandowd.shop.
Very good. Straightforward. I like that. That's good. I mean, I as an English teacher to another English teacher, there's no better way, I think, of getting people to think about big issues than through writing, and through getting them to think about, instead of the dry facts, which actually are pretty horrifying and moving, actually, for the case of the witch trials, but for people to think about the characters as being real people, real women with real experiences. I think that clicks something in our minds about the empathy of it, to think, well, these were just women. So I think what you're doing is really great from that point of view, particularly.
Yeah, I think one of the things I did try to do when I was teaching the Crucible was, and I didn't have my mum's book at the time, but I did have the programme from the original performance, and I used to take that in. And I think if they can identify with something like that happening locally where they live, then they see it as more real. And quite shocking, actually. They were quite shocking. Yeah.
And was the story in Alloa well known already?
No, I don't think it was. I think now, just lately, through Karen's work, through my mum's work, and now because of the internet, these are more easily available. The actual court trials, all of that is a lot more accessible than it used to be. In school, a lot of the children didn't know about it. So
yeah, that's something we found a lot. That's why one of our aims really is to do the podcast, so that people know about it. Because I didn't know anything about it. I mean, I'm from Fife, I grew up in Fife, and I didn't know anything at all about witch trials in Fife. And it turns out there were quite a few, you know, and had no knowledge of it at all growing up. So I think this is probably the most interesting aspect of the campaign altogether for me, has been learning about Scotland's history with reference to this, because we didn't know anything about it. So I think anything that people produce that makes people connect with that, and you're going to remember a story like that, is really valuable.
Yeah, I must admit, I was quite shocked myself to find out when my mum did her research. And actually going, sometimes walking around the town and to that particular area where there's an old cemetery, and there was a church there at one time, but there's just now a church tower left. And just, you can feel the history walking around that area. And I think now about the women that were locked up there waiting to be tried, probably in Stirling, but they were probably kept in that tower, which is still standing there today.
Mm.
Yeah, because along with Margaret being locked up, there were quite a number of others, weren't there? There were how many? 16 others accused of witchcraft?
Yeah, there was about 16, and I think from the trials there were four of them were burnt as witches, I think, at the end. And it just says that Margaret Dickle died before that could happen.
And there's no note of what happened to Margaret's body?
There's nothing that I've found. I'm still trying to find out more about it.
Because we know that with the parallel with Lilias Ady in Cooris and Fife, where tons of work's been done on her case, that she sounds quite similar. She died before, you know, a pronouncement was made on her guilt or innocence. And it seems that she'd also been tortured with sleep deprivation and so on. And then you'll know yourself that her body was packed away, like, you know, because they were supposedly so scared of her rising from the dead with the devils. So I was curious to know if there was any idea of what had happened to Margaret's remains.
No, I don't know anything as yet, but I will keep trying to find out. The cemetery itself is actually kept locked. You have to get the key from the council before you can actually get in there. But I know that the tomb of the Mars family are in there. They were quite powerful in Alloa at the time. In fact, I think it was the Lord Mar that was a sort of protector of James VI. They brought them up throughout his childhood in Stirling Castle. So there was quite a lot of links with James VI.
Because it was a lot of men. Claire, you know the technical name for these things, but it was a lot of men that were on the, I don't know, you wouldn't call it a panel, but the group of men that tried her.
Yes, they were either called or have been named as investigators or commissioners. And I think Mar was on that. They were very senior. And what made it all the worse to me was each of these women were judged in these cases, the 16 of them, by 23 men.
It just shows you the power that was behind all of that.
Yeah.
The control.
Yeah, because there were men from the church. There were local lords like Mar. I think we actually know the names of those people that were involved in that process.
And I think there was a Robert Bruce, who was, of course, related to a relative or a descendant of King Robert the Bruce. They were quite powerful around here as well.
It's amazing to see that there was a combination of sort of high people in society, people, the church, people with money, people with influence, and it was all these people that were involved in judging these poor women. I mean, they just did not stand.
Just imagine the idea of that, 23 men sitting in judgment in a room with one probably quite poor woman, you know, who presumably didn't really have the level of literacy, didn't have the power, didn't have defence in any way. Did they have defence, Claire, in these sorts of cases?
I don't think, they certainly don't have anything in the Devil's Mark that's identified as their defences.
No, it didn't look like it. And there seemed to be, I felt, with some of the other characters like Agnes and Nellie and Tam, and there was a childish sort of naivety that came over with them. It was almost as though they were, you know, they were like children gossiping in the street, or they were pushing and pulling each other. Then there was these chants as well, sort of the dance da conga. And there was one that was a bit like Ring a Ring of Roses, but it was Ring a Ring of Windershin, I think. Which I think, having looked a little bit at that, Widdershin's clockwise movement, isn't it? Yeah.
I think it's counterclockwise. That's ringing a bell, because I think in another episode we talked to somebody who had, oh my God, my memory's totally going, where somebody had talked about that, and we worked out what that meant. It was going anti-clockwise, and that was in somehow in league with the devil, because it was going against the right way around the clock. It was, you know, it was like anti-good.
Particularly if you went round a church, this was really seen as really bad luck, superstition. And I'm not sure what she was trying to show there, but to me, these little chants and dances were quite childish as well. We did these in the playground when we were younger, and quite an innocent sort of way, but it was made out that these were witches' dances. I think that one in particular is now called the Witches' Reel in the 1600s. So everything became a superstition or evil. I felt there was a bit of a deliberate idea of childish naivety into those characters to show perhaps how they were lacking in education and not developed educationally in some way.
Mm-hmm. But it's strange though when you see them interacting in the scene that I was talking about, where modern woman speaks to 17th, 18th century woman 19th century and right back. It's strange, although they're all speaking in their own times, like modern women speaking as you would just imagine you would see in a newspaper, you know, just somebody quoting something. Everyone was speaking in their own language in their own times. They all were actually speaking of the same experience. They were just speaking about it in a different way.
One of the things we wondered about was whether we should write, adapt the play into a kind of standard English version for international readers. I don't know if that's something we can do, or if it would take something away from the language and the atmosphere.
I suppose it's a balance, because you want as many people as possible to read the work. Maybe you could give them the original and the translation.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
That's a project for the future.
That's your next project. Well, I want to say, Hazel, we are absolutely delighted that you've been able to come to speak to us about this.
We really
hope that The Devil's Mark as a book does really, really well. We'll certainly obviously be promoting it when we are doing our stuff. And we hope maybe one day that you will be able to put it on as a play, and we'd be really, really delighted if that came to pass, that we could come and see it. So if there's ever any hint that it might be put on as a play, please do let us know, and please do stay in contact. It's a fantastic tribute that you're doing, not only to all those women that were killed as witches, but also to your mum, and I think it's absolutely lovely. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and I think everything that you're doing is fantastic.
Thanks so much for joining us this week for the Witches of Scotland podcast. Please do follow us on the different social media outlets, including Instagram, Facebook, and on Twitter. We are going to update all those ones with different links and things that relate to today's episode. And please also, if you haven't already, do sign up for the Eventbrite events that we're doing. So we're doing our own one on Sunday, and then there's the Paisley one on Monday, which is on actual International Women's Day. So we'll put the links up, but please do join us for them. They're all free.
And sign the petition.
Oh, yeah, do. Sign the petition. That's very important. And please keep telling people about it, because the numbers just keep trickling along now, and it's really good. So it'd be brilliant if we could get as many as possible in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, and can I say, finally, I am keeping a list. Some people contact us and say, please talk about this woman, please talk about that woman. I'm keeping a list of those, and we are working our way through them. So hopefully you'll be hearing some shout outs that people have given to us for women that we want to remember soon.
Brilliant. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
If you'd like to learn more about the Witches of Scotland, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Sign up for our mailing list at www.witchesofscotland.com to keep updated with the campaign. On that site, you'll be able to find how to link with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.